I'd like to welcome you all today to the panel entitled Performance. It is a tremendous pleasure and an honor to introduce today Professors Daphne Brooks and Amelia Jones. Both have been instrumental in shaping many fields, including theater and performance studies, visual art theory, art history, sound studies, literary criticism, American studies, to name only a handful. Given their respective areas of expertise, Brooks and Jones' convergence today offers us an exciting opportunity to engage with multidisciplinary aesthetics, politics, and ethics of performance's sonic and visual dimensions. So I don't want to play favorites, so I'm just going to introduce them in alphabetical order. Daphne Brooks is professor of African American Studies and Theater Studies at Yale University. Brooks has published many articles and books on a wide range of topics, from 19th century non-white female and queer performing artists to black cultural production and both high, quote-unquote, high and popular music, ranging from rock to opera. One of her books, for example, treats the music of artist Jeff Buckley. I can still recall the effective contours of my first encounter with Brooks's seminal monograph, Bodies in Descent, Spectacular Performances of Race and Freedom, 1850 to 1910. 8 years ago, my fellow graduate students and I had recently begun contemplating the ontology of a dissertation. Bodies in Descent arrived at just the right time. The book pivotally oriented us to the transformative potential of performance research and to all that archives and repertoires in their overlaps and disjunctions could make possible. Brooks's meticulous studies of Henry Box Brown, Ada Isaacs Menken, and Williams and Walker's In Dahomey, among other topics, reconfigured how we do performance scholarship, what it means, and why it matters. In her characteristic and lucid and elegant prose, her scholarship interprets interdisciplinary performances of past and present, illuminating vital genealogies of oppression, identification, movement, beauty, and resistance. Her forthcoming book, Subterranean Blues, Black Women Sound Modernity, will be published by Harvard University Press. Amelia Jones's intellectual investments are equally engaged and fruitful. Jones is professor and Robert A. Day Chair in Fine Arts and Vice Dean of Critical Studies at the Roski School of Art and Design at the University of Southern California. As is wonderfully stated on her faculty webpage, Jones, quote, practices a queer, anti-racist, feminist history and theory, end quote, of art and visual culture in the 20th and 21st centuries. Her research spans works of Duchamp, Man Ray, Ron Athey, Marina Abramovich, and Heather Castles, examining questions of intentionality, politics, deconstructionism, embodiment, and desire. I was fortunate to be Jones's colleague for a time here at McGill, where I experienced firsthand her theoretical heft and willingness to challenge received conventions in performance and visual arts, such as her critique of presence in Abramovich's work. With stores of energy that seem at times inconceivably vast, Jones publishes prolifically while mentoring students and organizing events, including curating an excellent group show at Concordia's Leonard and Bina Ellen Gallery, and Montreal's iteration of the PSI Fluid States Archipelago. Her books and articles, too numerous to catalog in full, include Seeing Differently, A History and Theory of Identification and the Visual Arts, Self-Image, Technology, Representation, and the Contemporary Subject, and Body Art, Performing the Subject. In addition, her edited volumes like Perform, Repeat, Record, and The Feminism and Visual Cultural Reader gather crucial theorists of visual art, culture, and performance in thought-provoking constellations. So our time is short, so without further ado, I'll yield the floor to these distinguished guests. Once again, please welcome our panelists, Daphne Brooks and Amelia Jones.
So thank you to Katie for that really elegant introduction. Really, really wonderful. And I've been saying to people in the hallway, I'm already so excited about this conference, I never want to leave. And I have to leave early tomorrow, which makes me really sad, and so I'm going to be watching. I'll be watching you to keep up with surveillance tactics. I have some thank yous, and then we'll start the clock, if that's okay. of course, thank you to Tamara and Mary and Sophie, to Jonathan and Nick for organizing this gathering and for inviting me to participate, to the grad student delegates who are just like badass in the back and like doing all sorts of things as an ensemble together. I'm thrilled to be here with you all today. So on the plane last night, I decided just to do a different paper, so which seemed more fitting for this gathering. And I love my intuition when it works right, because I was going to talk about black women musicians and driving, and then I realized that Corinne has a book that I absolutely need to purchase and read, speed read tonight, and I'm so excited to be in conversation with her work. So I'm going to do this other thing that I think still works, and actually I think works better for, or not works, I don't know if it works, but I feel like it's in conversation with a lot of the questions that have been raised already today. So we'll see. You can tell me. Final quick note about the form of this talk. There's lots of images, lots of music ahead. My style of reading, which Jonathan already knows, in particular, is to talk through and besides sonic texts in the Sedgwickian and Jose Munozian sense of being beside one another. And what that means is that, especially if you're musicians, that might drive you crazy, but you may occasionally want to hear something more, and I'm happy to return to tracks in the Q&A. So let's go ahead and start. Oh, yeah, also, I don't know how long this talk is, so you should just raise your hand and tell me to shut the F up when I'm, right? We'll just see how we're doing. We may not get to Zora Neale Hurston. I'm also happy to talk about her in the whatchamacallit. So let's see. So halfway through her exuberant 2013 album, The Electric Lady, it would seem that we, the listeners, are tied to the mast, while Afrofuturist heroine Janelle Monáe sings the song of the siren. Look into my eyes, let them hypnotize. These eyes long to make you a perfect work of art. All awash in shimmering guitars and swelling strings, look into my eyes conjures up Italian cinematic mise-en-scène, ballroom quiche, and shades of 007 intrigue as Monáe putatively assumes the role of the classic femme fatale, beckoning a lover to succumb to her alluring, transformative powers. Fall in love with me, only then you'll see what these eyes have been planning for you. Woman, as sensuous seductress, unleashes her sonic powers onto her betrothed in order to seemingly control and sexually dominate. It's a scene that Monáe's thrillingly oblique, culturally heterogeneous liner notes for her album, of which I'll speak more about in a bit, links directly to the stuff of myth by citing Book 12 of the Odyssey and announcing that the song is inspired by the temptation of the sirens. To be sure, it's a seemingly odd move for this critical and academic darling who's been hard at work with her ensemble of Wonderland Arts Collective collaborators, spinning a sprawling, insurgent, Afropunk sci-fi opera that boldly traffics in black freedom struggle politics. To figure herself as the primitive natural forces that Odysseus must withstand would appear to undermine the black feminist theoretical underpinnings of Monáe's celebrated act. After all, Janelle Monáe, dubbed in a raucous interlude on the Electric Lady album as our favorite fugitive, would seem to be the stuff of performance studies, black studies, and feminist studies dreams. A marvelously whimsical icon of Afrofuturist post-human alterities, she's black cultural studies manna from heaven. A musician, entertainer, performance artist who gives the gift that keeps on giving to a scholarly world that delights in unscrambling the alluring theoretical codes of her core mythology narrative involving alt-ego Cindy Mayweather, an android on the run from the state who has transgressed laws regarding the limits of android intimacy and feeling. Think Ziggy Stardust crossed with Octavia Butler. Think abolitionist Henry Box Brown and the cross-dressing Ellen Craft, crossed with Grace Jones and LaBelle. Monáe's highly literary, cinematic, and sonic escapology is a form of aesthetic othering and fugitive tactics predicated upon excessive citation that aims to elude representational circumscription. To critics such as Francesca Royster, she is the androgynous artist who lives in the crossroads of glam rock, punk, funk, and soul genealogies, a poster child for dissident post-soul identity formations and black eccentricities that disturb ossified racial authenticity politics. That Little Richard Pompadour, that godfatherly cape, those wonder-inspired, empathic urban anthems, those bad brains, body slamming jams, that Jackson 5 era Michael angst-ridden crooning in the upper registers, the Sun Ra Clintonian mythological futurity of her live act, recordings and growing archive of cultural marginalia, graphic novels, an off-Broadway musical in the works, we think. To cultural critic Shana Redman, she is an artist who sustains black diasporic traditions, arts traditions, in which the cultural realm is always in play and already politically significant terrain. She evidences an intelligent design, Redman argues, rooted in black feminist constructions that wed body to mind and experience to history, all of which makes the Siren Song reference all the more curious and intriguing. Adorno and Horkheimer would, of course, notoriously use the myth as, among other things, a way to contemplate women as representative of nature in bourgeois society, an enigma of irresistibility and powerlessness. Thus, quote unquote, a woman reflects back, they argue, the vain lie of power which substitutes the mastery over nature for reconciliation with it. As Rita Felsky and other feminist scholars have observed, the repressed feminine of aesthetic and libidinal forces returns in Adorno and Horkheimer in the form of the engulfing regressive of lures of modern mass culture and consumer society, which trades inauthentic pleasure and pseudo-happiness for acquiescence to the status quo, masculine rationalization in the form of Odysseus's ability to withstand the song of the siren, and feminine pleasure are simply two sides of a coin in the dialectic of enlightenment, according to Felsky. Together, she argues, masculine rationalization and the feminine produce a seamless logic of domination that constitutes modern subjectivity through processes of subjugation. With seemingly no room in their thesis for the hermeneutic agency of social subjects and the polysemic richness of cultural text, however, we should assume that Monet is ringing a different kind of alarm. Pace Beyonce here. I had to throw in some Beyonce. For what may seem initially like cliched feminine sexual danger turns swiftly into a hailing of a different order altogether. You lift my heart when I fly, sings a rebel girl. Good morning, good night, it's a brave new world dawning, what lovers meant to see. As Suite 4 of Monet's epic comes to a gentle yet ominous close, the figure of the siren transforms from Western myth into Black Undercommon's messianic heroine, the one who will lead not just her lover, but presumably multiple disaffected publics who are addressed across a range of recordings out of the quagmire of dystopia by way of song and dance. Fall in love with me, cross the golden sand, there's a road winding up into sunrise. To fall for Monet here is to fall for black heterogeneous culture as Afro-alienated revolution. And in this regard, perhaps the siren trope is ultimately not so misplaced. For as feminist music theorist Barbara Eng has argued, what the femme fatale reading of the Odysseus myth has forgotten entirely is the historical power of the sirens, which Adorno and Horkheimer acknowledge as such when they contend that the quote-unquote siren songs has not yet been rendered powerless by reduction to the condition of art, but rather contains the potential for cognition and social practice. Monet sounds the siren of social practice, which is set to the beat of Fred Moden, Nathaniel Mackey, Hortense Spillers, and certainly Donna Haraway, since she offers a kind of black feminist versioning of the cyborg manifesto that celebrates partiality, irony, intimacy, and perversity. Yes, we are living in a much-talked-about pop moment where gendered artifice and spectacle rule with a range of political gestures and studiously vacuous posturing, some more than others. Figure out the continuum for yourself, but Queen Bey and Gaga to Katie and Nikki. But Monet's act, more than all the others, engages the politics of the archive. I might say Beyonce too, but again, she keeps coming back to me. Cultural memory and the poetics of writing sound that move in self-consciously political excess of her peers. The counter-mythology that she and her co-conspirators are weaving together is a work both of cultural criticism and a story of archival immensity, incompletion, opacity, and the perpetual pursuit of collecting and repurposing images, sound, and material objects, cinematic moments and text, disparate cultural iconographies, and ephemeral cultural incidents that together make audible the critical sensations, complex perceptions, and intellectual labor of black women culture workers. What I want to argue for today, then, is a way to use Janelle Monae as a way into the way back, so to speak, as the portal, she would no doubt insist, the time tunnel, through which we might access a long line of artists and intellectuals. Zora Neale Hurston, and others who constitute a secret history, Pace Grail Marcus, if you will, of cultural archivist critics who use the techniques of black feminist phonography, dissident media and mediations of the sonic and the discursive that manipulate technologies of modernity so as to work within and against modernity and to ultimately sound it anew. So some thoughts about blackness and modernity before moving to Monet and landing, hopefully, in the world of Zora. So my work is, of course, deeply indebted to critics such as Alex Wahalia and his pathbreaking theorizations of black phonographies as a kind of modern cultural production and theorization of aesthetics that, in the vein of Du Bois and Ellison, and I would say also Pauline Hopkins, neither abandons the graph for the phono, and it blends sensation and perception and listens to the variety and intensity of their intermingling in the articulation of blackness. For Wahalia, the novel cleft between sound and source initiated by the technology of the phonograph in the 20th century black culture supplies, as he calls it, the grooves of sonic Afro-modernity. Quote, by drastically reconstructing the flow between sounds and identifiable human source, the technology of the phonograph worried the complex intersection of orality, music, and writing, thus creating a gateway for black cultural producers and consumers to productively engage this split to create a variety of musics, literary texts, and films that disturb conventional notions of temporality, spatiality, and community in such a way as to allow for black subjects to structure and sound their positionalities within and against Western modernity. In sum, as he's put it very famously, no Western modernity without sonic blackness, he concludes, and no blackness in the absence of modernity. Now, Wahalia is clearly building on the work of more than two decades worth of scholarship that asserts how we cannot assume that black folks just rolled over or got rolled by modernity. And I'm thinking here of field-defining work by Cedric Robinson, Paul Gilroy, the late, great Lyndon Barrett, and, of course, Fred Moten, as well as Jana Brown, who has given us probably the most cogent extended meditation on black women in relation to modernity, primarily by way of the kinesthetic. These are all my peeps, and their work is also inspiring me to shift the discussion push the discussion to ask what it means to listen as well as to read the work of black women who labor at and who critique the core of culture by way of sound. As phonographers, old school and new school women, Zora Neale Hurston and Janelle Monáe refuse the narrow sociocultural constructs assigned to black women vocalists, which Farrah Griffin has influentially critiqued, the ones that figure black sonic women as the repository of putatively audible racial authenticity politics, as healers of national communities in times of crisis, and likewise the founding sound of the New World Black Nation. If black women's sonic work has consistently been vulnerable to being used and misused as fuel for the engines of modernity, so shoring up the nation state, think Whitney at the Super Bowl, or expanding industrialized market industries, think Mamie Smith and the advent of the blues records, race records explosion. It has also been the site where they have improvised new mechanisms of self-identity, which are shaped by, yet also shape the institutions of identity, as sociologist Anthony Giddens might put it. As phonographers, a range of black women artists critically engage the sociocultural conditions of their own production and reproduction by way of mediating the phono and the graph. They record, replay, listen to, arrange, and rearrange the worlds that they choose to traverse at the intersections of the sonic and the discursive. And more still, and quite critically, they inscribe the body in their graph projects and vice versa. They make black womanhood audible, sensorially present as archive and as instruments of the repertoire. And here I mean to suggest that we think not just about the Bargian, I'm trying to neologize that and I don't know, grain of the voice, but the ways that they interpolate gesture, vision, affective listening, and detail, paste the brilliant work of my former colleague Alexandra Vasquez, into their sonic and written performances as modes of sociopolitical and cultural critique. So if you'll indulge me, let me linger just a moment longer with Monáe in order to illustrate these provocative dimensions of her work that might serve as a bridge to Zora, a figure who left behind a blueprint for her to remix. Where each of these artists take us is to the place where women wield their own archival, technological, and performative modes of mediation to disturb the exploitation of black women's sound as modernity's stabilizing device. Monet's heralded arc-android mythology is fanciful, metatextual, and intertextual, and way too circuitous to describe in detail here. But of course, I'm happy to discuss ad nauseum during the Q&A. But let me extract a few key points so as to contextualize the claims I want to make for now. 27-year-old Kansas City native Janelle Monae Robinson is the performer who has assumed the persona of Janelle Monae, human from the future, the year 2719, who, as the liner notes from her first full-length album describe it in the vein of Philip K. Dickensian pulp science fiction, was body-snatched, geno-raped, had her genetic code sold illegally to the highest bidder at a body farm, and was forced into a time tunnel and sent back to our era. Out of the DNA grist of Monae comes the rogue android Cindy Mayweather. The Monae-Mayweather mythology takes us to the place of fantastic split personas, a land where black women musicians rarely ever have the luxury to reside, forced instead to adhere to the demands of representational transparency. What's more, though, this spectacular narrative presents us with a distillation of a dyadic heroine who moves across space and time, recording, sharing, and transmitting arcane objects, ideas, and cultural memories between her past and future selves. Songs are somewhere on this piece of paper that I've lost track of. Songs are the archive, the place where historical knowledge and forms of remembrance are accumulated, stored, and recovered. And they run the gamut from urban lamentations to battle cries, from dance manifestos to romance anthems, serving ultimately as revolutionary code, the weapons to fight the ominously titled Cold War, what we're watching and listening to right now, that human and droid are waging far apart and yet simultaneously with one another. It's an epic drama, critically framed by the aforementioned liner notes. This pains me to cut through this. Now we're going to get into some way lowbrow tech here. The liner notes, the form that illuminates the extent to which Monae and her collective are radicalizing the genre by showcasing and interpolating into the frame of the narrative itself the practices of collecting, archiving, and utilizing culture as critique. Nearly an extinct form in mainstream pop recordings of today, liner notes are all but confined to the world of classic jazz and box set reissues at this point, with some exceptions. But at the peak of their preeminence as a stamp of cultural credibility in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, these textual appendices to recordings sealed the chasm between lowbrow and highbrow music product, between pop commodity and serious music. Having evolved in the early decades of the recording industry from basic discursive media on album inner sleeve linings, hence the name, and jackets containing brief artist biographies and label ads, to ambitious works of cultural criticism produced by music journalists and on occasion the artists themselves, liner notes emerged in the first golden age of jazz criticism in the 50s and the equally hallowed days of rock criticism in the 60s and early 70s as a canonizing form of pop music discourse. By way of either the essay that anoints an artist and a musical object as being of value and calibrating the taste of the listener, think of the trenchant work of Leonard Feather, Nate Hentoff, or Rolling Stone co-founder Ralph J. Gleason, or by operating as a discursive space wherein the music artist might expand on, complement, complicate, and or subvert the accompanying sonic text, think Coltrane, Dylan, Zappa. Liner notes hold out the possibility of functioning as the critical, the fictional, the experimental. The most ambitious notes strive towards the discursive realization or the discursive reimagining of a sonic collection of songs. The list of black feminist critics who've engaged in the genre is small. The great Talani Davis was the first to win a Grammy for her work in 1992 for Aretha's Atlantic Recordings box set. And the list of black women musicians who've authored their own notes is even smaller. Into this idiosyncratic literary tradition enters Janelle Monae, whose liner notes, like her songwriting, compositions, and studio production efforts, are consistently figured as ensemble endeavors between Robinson, creative director and co-songwriter, producer Charles, a.k.a. Chuck Lightning Joseph, and composers Nate Wonder and Roman G. Arthur. I could say a lot more about them in the Q&A. They're extraordinary. Janelle Monáe's revival of the notes genre imagines the conventions of the form, not quite spiritual meditation like that of Coltrane's 1964 Love Supreme notes, nor stream of consciousness experimentalism like Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited Labyrinth. Monáe's notes are most akin to, for instance, Sun Ra's freeform poetry on Space is the Place that underwrites the alterity of his alien persona and abstruse counterpublics. Monáe and crew use the space of the notes to launch the mythology. Behold the story of a living hero turned into a runaway fugitive, but also to play with this idea of archival and performative exchange between the split heroine self. The album matter for her two full-length recordings assembles fragments of documents, letters addressed to the listener from a narrator figure of sorts, Max Stellings, vice chancellor of the Palace of the Dogs Arts Asylum, who outlines the exploits of Monáe Mayweather and provides contextual suspense and intrigue for each album's collection of musical material. Quote, "Is Janelle Monáe crazy?" Stellings asks. "Is she truly from the year 2719? Is she making music with apparitions? Is her direct clone descendant the arch-android Mayweather?" Stellings' two letters describe both albums as the quote-unquote songs, texts, and images of Janelle Monáe, Palace of the Dogs patient number 57821. And on The Electric Lady, the text pushes the suggestion that we recognize the circuitry between human and the present and droid of the future. Monáe, now a fugitive herself, having escaped from the arts asylum, leaves behind recordings of secret compositions conveyed to her by Mayweather. She is thus machine cloned from woman and woman preserving and disseminating the machinely workings of her cloned android self. Thus a gorgeous slow burn of an anthem like Victory, which we're listening to right now, is, we are told in the trademark annotations to each of the songs on her albums, inspired by the life and times of Janelle Monáe. And likewise, the off-the-wall era, Michael Seduction, Come On, Can't Live Without Your Love, is inspired by, we're told, the midnight dreams of Sidney Mayweather. The dizzying self-referentiality and citationality of the notes affirm a kind of alt-sonic universe in which black women and femme Borg presumably telepath sound to one another, for Mayweather performs in her own time as well, to protect, preserve, and exchange the exigencies of their respective affective experiences. The latest album itself is then a recording within a recording. Monáe is the phonographic archive, the performing repository of her future human and post-human self, the media and mediator who toggles between the discursive citationality of the notes and the polyvalent resonances of her embodied performances. The notes then move beyond the standard pop work of the liner genre to sustain the meta-selves in Janelle Monáe's repertoire and to present songs as sites of declarative inspiration in and of themselves, of eccentric cultural marginalia. Songs are inspired by, quote, Princess Leia's cinnamon buns hairstyle, Jack White's mustache, by global art house cinematic characters like Lil Zay in City of God, by archival objects like James Brown's cape, by fanciful metaphors like the atomic bombs in Muhammad Ali's fists. Songs are inspired by performative gestures of the now, a stage dive at the Bonnaroo Festival, or fleeting subterranean moments on film, the she's crying, it's backwards scene in Purple Rain, the Jeep sequence in Carmen Jones. The notes also tell us that songs are inspired by imagined moments of the what might be, the idea of Ennio Morricone playing cards with Duke Ellington, and synesthesian encounters with the world, such as the song inspired by, again the notes tell us, Hidden Colors and The Burning Big House in Django Unchained. The opacity and fragmentation of these references suggest yet another way as well to read the notes, as what poet Kevin Young might describe as a kind of shadow book. And my hearty thanks to the brilliant critic Shane Vogel for inspiring this particular thread of my thinking here. Young identifies three kinds of shadow books in the Black literary tradition. First, those books that fail to be written or completed, think Ellison's second novel. Secondly, those books that are the shadow of the one that we have, texts that call attention to their incompletion, think Harriet Jacobs' Incidents and Life of a Slave Girl. And thirdly, those books that are altogether lost. As a shadow book of the second order, Monet's liner notes cite that which cannot be captured or contained in writing, but which must be experienced through sound and other dimensions of sight, the cinematic, beyond the note page. We, the dear listeners hailed by Stellings, are invited to engage with the world via her archival sensory experience. As the Electric Lady slides into track number two, my favorite track, the Slinky Prince duet, Given What They Love, the burn this mother down ambition of the song's lyrics assume a quietly ferocious tenacity by way of that menacing rhythm section, that sinuous rhythm guitar, the reciprocating androgyny of Monet and the Purple One's tense powder keg vocals, and the shadow of inspiration in a Tarantino plantation master's big house going up in flames. Vogel and perhaps Brent Edwards as well might call this a sensuous form of archiving, collecting and assembling images that reference sight, sound, touch, the juxtaposed seemingly disparate figures and objects and fragments of memories in order to document a culturally vast world of experiences rooted in the senses and dialectically constitutive of Monet's sonic repertoire. What Janelle Monáe's work presents us with, then, is a way of reading the archive as repertoire, and most importantly, how Black feminist phonographies make this possible. We know, of course, oh so well by way of many a post-structuralist, psychoanalytic, and or cultural studies theorist, the extent to which the archive persists as an instantiation of institutional power on the one hand and marginalized longing on the other. It is the first and last word in history, the site of a kind of institutional violence that shelters, preserves, and presents itself as revealing, even as it conceals histories of subjugation. Archives, we know by now, contain the potential to fragment and destabilize either remembrance as recorded or history as written, a sufficient means of proving the final say in the account of what has come to pass. Diana Taylor's influential rejoinder here recuperates the repertoire of embodied memory, the live, which exceeds the archive's ability to capture, and performance as the means to transmitting communal memories, histories, and values from one group or generation to the next. Embodied and performed acts, she insists, generate, record, transmit knowledge. Taylor is also quick to point out that we needn't think in binaries, that would lead us to presume that the written and archival constitute hegemonic power, and the repertoire provides the anti-hegemonic challenge. We need not polarize the relationship between those different kinds of knowledge to acknowledge that they often proved antagonistic in the struggle for cultural survival or supremacy. But performance theorist Rebecca Schneider helpfully pushes beyond Taylor's work, arguing that, quote-unquote, when we approach performance not as that which disappears, as the archive expects, but as both the act of remaining and a means of reappearance and re-participation, we are almost immediately forced to admit that remains do not have to be isolated to the document, to the object, to bone versus flesh. Monet's brand of phonography further destabilizes these categories. Her synesthesian discursive texts and sonic recordings are mutually constitutive of one another. Archive and repertoire run back and forth like a neon circuit, critique and interrogate each other. My contention is that we think of Monet's media and mediation of these two realms as not only a kind of phonography that showcases the virtuosic sense perception of a Black feminist artist who transgresses the limits of time and space by way of her sono-discursive practices, but that we also recognize her work as an artist as akin to that of the phonograph itself, as well as the phonograph record. Ah, the phonograph. That late Victorian device and Edisonian invention that, in its earliest incarnations, both recorded and played back sound, which many people in this room have done influential work to help us think and complicate about the genealogies of that instrument. Adorno would ask of this machine in his infamous 1927 essay, Curves of the Needle, what good is this thing to woman, since he argues, quote, the female voice requires the physical appearance of the body that carries it, and it is just this body that the phonograph eliminates, thereby giving every female voice a sound that is needy and incomplete. Many a feminist theorist has rallied against this claim, and there's clearly much to say in opposition to such an observation, the ways that it perpetuates the gendering of immanence versus transcendence, for instance, as Ang points out. But what if we were to interrupt this equation and take seriously the idea of Monet Mayweather machine, the Monet Mayweather machine, as a millennial new model phonograph, one that revels in generating the sound of a mischievously incomplete voice that calls out to other forms in the ways that I've been discussing, and moreover, that defies the kind of high-fidelity abstraction that Adorno fretted would lead to alienation. If the gramophone, as he refers to it here, needs to be complemented by specific sensory qualities of the object it is reproducing and on which it depends in order to remain at all related to that object, our electric dame and droid supply these qualities in the form of the notes, the citational vocal body and compositions, the referential visual and sartorial aesthetics. The black feminist phonographer here uses her body as the instrument of reproduction as well as the record itself, conduit of archaic knowledge preserved for a later time, as our German friend refers to it in a later essay. Through the curves of the needle on the phonograph record, music approaches decisively its true character's writing. Records transform the most recent sound of old feelings into an archaic text of knowledge to come. The curves of Janelle Monáe's needle write sound and likewise generate sound writing, which inscribe new black feminist knowledges of subjectivity shaped and informed by musicking. In doing so, she shares the turntable with those that came before her. What I'm urging us to do is to think of Janelle Monáe as situated in the midst of a long, complex, and heretofore unheralded history of black women figuring themselves as records and recorders, archivists and archives, sound and source. And so my remaining time is short. I was going to talk a little bit about how Zora does that. I'm trying to decide whether I should cut it off or not. I'm going to play a little bit of Zora Neale Hurston, and she'll play us out. We can talk more about this. So let's hit the replay button on Zora Neale Hurston so we can better hear her across the centuries and through the Everglades, singing out to us, giving us a soundtrack to accompany, complement, and contradict her critical writing. But be warned, Bessie Smith, she was not.
Don't favor me, Evelina. Evelina, don't you tell your mama it belonged to me. Hey, hey, you know the baby don't favor me.
So while no scholar in her right mind would dispute the fact that Zora Neale Hurston revolutionized and revitalized the voices of black folk in her fiction, drama, and anthropological scholarship, you'd most likely be hard-pressed to find anyone who would call her a great singer. Most people, in fact, may not even know that the Harlem Renaissance rebel writer sang at all, let alone that during the late 1930s she readily and dynamically performed and recorded a colorful array of songs that she herself collected out in the field. I'm not going to talk too much about these songs right now, but I did want to I wanted to emphasize a way of thinking about Zora's vastly influential theoretical writings, especially her essay, Characteristics of Negro Expression, does a kind of work that's sort of like a pre-liner notes tradition of thinking of ways of theorizing her sound and her sound ethnographies. And that if we think about this kind of tradition of the toggling in between these forms sensorially that black women artists engage in, we also have a way of kind of re-theorizing blackness and gender in relation to modernity. That was the main thing I was going to say, and I think maybe that might be where I'm going to end. So thank you very much.